Good morning. There's a sign-in sheet going around that people could please sign in and provide their email address. We include email addresses for a very important reason, specifically that I often find after a shiur is over that I come across something, some idea, or something percolates in my head and I want to add it. You know, there's actually a friend of mine has a website that is called Treppenwitz, which apparently is a term in German for wisdom of the stairs. And what it means is the ideas that come to you when you're walking down the stairs after having left the party where you had some conversation and you realize, oh, that's what I should have said. That's what he calls Treppenwitz. So I don't know if that's a term he made up or if that's a real thing. But I often find after a shiur I have Treppenwitz, you know, what I would have liked to have said. So if you could please make sure to sign in with your email address, then I'll be able to actually send you whatever brilliant thoughts occur to me afterwards. I want to thank Rabbi Kirzner for opening up the shul to this and for providing breakfast for us. It's always good to come here on Sunday mornings and to have a shiur. Also, of course, Yair gives a Gemara shiur here on Shabbos afternoons before Mincha. Mizrahi Bayit is always a great host. This is not an Iyun shiur. This is not going to be, let's learn the Gemara in depth and see, you know, we'll see a fine point within between two words, and that's going to give us a new insight. Those shiurim are wonderful. That's not what this is. This is a combination of history and philosophy. Trying to understand what exactly happened when the Torah was translated into Greek, and what that can teach us about the attitude that we have towards not just Greek, but towards translation of Torah in general, and the encounter that that took place then and continues to take place between Judaism and other cultures. So someone asked me this morning, is this the right date to be giving this shiur? Shouldn't this shiur have been a week ago? And the answer is yes, but no one was around a week ago. So we ended up doing it today. But you're right, it should have really been last week. If you take a look at source number one on the handouts, you see this from the Bahag, the Baal Halachas Gedolos, a work of Halacha, one of the first written codes of Halacha, from, I believe, the 10th century. One of the earliest sources to associate the translation into Greek with the 8th of Teves, which was last Tuesday. B'shmona b'Teves nichtava ha-Torah Yevanis b'mei Talmai ha-Melech. On the 8th of Teves, the Torah was written in Greek in the days of King Talmai. He doesn't give us a long story, an explanation of who did it and why they did it or whatever. He just says, this is what happened. But he says, Uvach choshech la'olam shlosha yamim, darkness came to the world for 3 days. He doesn't explain why darkness came to the world for 3 days, but he says 3 days of darkness followed this translation. And then we're told about events of the 9th of Teves and events from the 10th of Teves, which are interesting as well. I believe Yair actually has a shiur on the about the 9th of Teves, and feel free to speak to him afterwards to understand that. That's a shiur in and of itself. But we are taught this happens on the 8th day of Teves, and it is a bad thing for Klal Yisrael, for the Jewish people. This is brought in the Torah. It's brought in the Shulchan Aruch in Orach Chaim Tav Kuf Hei. The translation event is generally traced to the time of Ptolemy II, who is indeed the king in Egypt. And we roughly date it as the middle of the 3rd century before the Common Era. In other words, about 100 years before the events of Hanukkah. So if you think of Hanukkah as being about 160-ish or so before the Common Era, 160 to 170 before the Common Era, this is about 80 to 100 years before that happens. It's unclear that this translation that's done in the days of Ptolemy II is the Septuagint that we have. Septuagint itself is a term that's used today for a Greek translation of not just Chumash, which is what we're talking about here, but all of Tanakh, and it gets the name Septuagint as Greek for 70. Actually, the full name is Versio Septuaginta Interpretum. So it's the translation of the 70 into Greek.
That's Latin.
That's Latin, correct, but that's the way we get the term for the Septuagint. I saw you like processing that. The truth of the matter is that the translation that we are going to discuss today seems to be some kind of precursor of that Septuagint. First of all, know that there were many editions of the Greek translation with significant variation in between them. Second, the changes don't match what we have in in the description, the changes that we're going to see recorded in the Gemara don't match the changes that are in today's Septuagint. It's entirely possible that this is in fact a process that starts in the 3rd century before the Common Era and then continues for some time thereafter. But what I want to address are four questions. Number one, the classic whodunit / whydunit. Meaning, you have to know that in order for the Torah to go from the original Hebrew into Greek, there must have been sages who knew Hebrew and who knew Greek who sat down and did the translation. Right? I mean, that's elementary. We get the Torah in Hebrew because Hashem gives it to us. How does Torah come into Greek? Someone's got to know Hebrew and someone has to know Greek. So we know that it's done by sages. What we don't know is why. What's the motive? Why does someone sit down and devote what had to be a great deal of time in order to translate this text into Greek? So that's our first question is who's doing it and why are they doing it? Number two, there are many variations in the account of this translation. What are we supposed to learn from the variations between them? Number three, we did ultimately accept, as you may have seen in the prep time, Greek as a language of translation for Torah. Why is that? Why should we accept Greek of all languages for Jews of those times? Why Greek? Why should Greek become a language for Torah? And then finally, if we have time for it, I aim this to be between 45 minutes and an hour, so we'll see if we get to it. But what happened to turn things around? Because we're going to see an overall positive attitude towards Greek suddenly go very negative with a ban on studying Greek. What exactly is going on there? So there's a lot that I'd like to cover. I have to note that some of the ideas that I'm going to express are thoughts that I have based on what I've been learning and reviewing and looking at different points of view, but I'm not entirely sure of my own view on this, and so therefore I really welcome, even more so than usual, challenge on this. Let's take a look at source number two. Source number two brings us the most popular explanation of how it was that the Torah came to be translated into Greek. This is a story that is taught certainly in grade school when they teach the event, if they teach it at all. This is the account that's used. So, Rabbi Yehuda, the Gemara in Megillah. Rabbi Yehuda says, "Afkeshe itiru rabosenu yivanis lo itiru ela b'sefer Torah." He says, even when our sages permitted Greek, meaning to use Greek as a language to record holy books, kisvei kodesh, lo itiru ela b'sefer Torah, it was only for a sefer Torah that they permitted it. I added in brackets, meaning you're not allowed to render the Nevi'im, the prophets, in Greek. Why did they permit the Sefer Torah? Umishamase de Talmai Hamelech. Because of the incident, the event that happened with King Ptolemy. Disanya, here is a brisa. The sages from the period of time, the end of the Second Temple, record this lesson. Maase betamei amelach shekineh shivim ushnayim zekenim v'echnisam b'shivim ushnayim batim. Once, King Ptolemy, without any motive recorded here in the text, took 72 sages and put them in 72 different houses. V'lo gila lahem amakin san, and he didn't tell them why he was doing this. He didn't say, I am bringing you in to do the translation. He said, Rabbi so-and-so, you're going into this house. Rabbi so-and-so, you're going into this house. And the rabbis have no idea what actually is happening to them. V'nichnas etzel kol echad v'echad. Then he went into each one individually. V'amar lahem, and he said to them, Kisvuli Torah Moshe Rabchem. Record for me the Torah of Moshe your master. Nasan HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'leiv kol echad v'echad. Etzel, God put counsel in the hearts of each one. The Eskimu Kulon Ledas Achas, and all of them came up with the same ideas. Now, not just in terms of the accurate translation, but also apparently in terms of certain variations. And the Kasvulo, and they wrote for him, Elokim Bara Bereshis. The Gemara goes on to list many more changes. This is just one of them. I didn't want to focus too much on the changes themselves. That's a shir in its own right. But Elokim bara Bereshis instead of Bereshis bara Elokim. What's the difference between Bereshis bara Elokim and Elokim bara Bereshis?
Inspiration.
Right, who is gracious, right. If you phrase it Elohim, bara gracious, this is the way we usually understand this this alteration. If you worded gracious bara Elohim, it almost sounds like gracious created God, which is nonsense in a Torah context, but lest anybody thinks so, Elohim bara gracious. There's more to it than that, but that's our standard approach to understanding that change. But that's one version of the story. Take a look at source number 3, please. Masechet Sofrim. Masechet Sofrim may be a little bit new for some. The Gemara is composed of Masechtot, volumes that are sort of the standard text of Mishnah, recorded and ultimately canonized in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era, then expanded upon in the Gemara with its discussions that are canonized in the 6th century. However, there were also texts which existed from the times of the Mishnah in some form. They're redacted a little bit later than the Mishnah, and they are called Masechtos Ketanos, literally small volumes. And the Masechet Sofrim is one of those volumes. And it records for us the laws of writing Sifrei Kisvei Kodesh, writing holy scrolls, whether you talk about Torah, whether you talk about Nevi'im. So, Ein Kosvin Sefer Torah, I added in the word Sefer Torah just for clarity, Lo Ivris Velo Aramis Velo Midis Velo Yavanis. You're not allowed to write a Torah scroll, not in Ivrit, not in Aramit. Ivrit here is what is often called Paleo-Semitic, the older Hebrew alphabet, as opposed to the Assyrian Savashuri that we use. So you're not supposed to write it in Ivrit alphabet. You're not supposed to write it in Aramit, Aramaic. We're now jumping from alphabet to language. So not only are you supposed to use our font, the Ashurit font, the Assyrian font as we call it, but you're also supposed to use Hebrew, not Aramaic, Velo Midit, not Mid, Velo Yavanis, not Greek. None of those are to be used. If you wrote it in one of these other languages, if you wrote it in one of these other fonts, one of these other alphabets, can't read it. Can't be used for the Torah reading. It has to be written with the Assyrian alphabet and in Lashon HaKodesh, in our language. And then we're told, once, 5 elders, again, no explanation of motivation, 5 elders wrote the Torah for a Talmai in Greek, and that was as bad as the day that the golden calf was created. Why? Now we get an explanation for why this is a bad thing. Because the Torah couldn't be translated properly. You can't render the Torah accurately into Greek. So now we find out why we don't like translations. Because the translation isn't honest. You can't get it right. Which is an interesting counterpoint to what we saw in the previous source, in which they changed things on purpose. Right? The previous source said they changed things because they wanted to avoid misunderstandings, or one of the changes, they wanted to avoid offending. Here, we're told that they changed things because they couldn't help it. Because you can't translate it properly. Not only that, how many elders did this? 5. And we don't know anything about separate rooms or a plot by Talmai or anything. But then, Shub Maaseh continues, B'Talmai HaMelech. It happened again with King Ptolemy, who apparently had a habit of this. Shekineh Shivim Ushnaim Zekadim. Now, there were about 7 Ptolemies, so maybe this means there's another Ptolemy who did this. But he does the whole song and dance routine with 72 elders in 72 houses, and he doesn't tell them what's going on, and he tells each one individually, and they all change the same things with Ruach HaKodesh. That's the rest of source number 3. Then you get an account in source number 4 from the Masechet Sefer Torah, which is generally associated also with those original added or smaller Masechtot, smaller volumes. And here we find elements of what we saw in source number 3, because I think you probably had a chance to see this in the prep time. I'm not going to go through it individually with the inside the text itself, except to note that how many elders did it here? 70. Now we have 70 elders. By the way, the language there, Ilmit, that I had in italics, Elam is usually associated, I believe, with Bavel. So I think Ilmit is Aramaic. The Ilmit would be the language of Elam, it would be a reference to Aramaic. But it's as harsh as the day that the calf was created because the Torah could not be properly translated, and it also lists the changes. Now, there are other places in which this is recorded in the Gemara without the story at all. In the Gemara and in similar sources. There's the Targum Yerushalmi in Megillah just says that they changed... the Talmud Yerushalmi in Megillah says that they just changed... certain things on behalf of Ptolemy. The Medrash Tanchuma in Shmos, in a couple of different places, Avos D'Rabbi Nasan. So there are other things. There are variations between the accounts. The most obvious variation between the accounts is how many elders were involved. So we saw one that said 5, at least once. That appears in Avos D'Rabbi Nasan as well. We saw one that said 70. We had one that said 72. By the way, why would 72... What's 72 to us?
Sanhedrin.
72 on a Sanhedrin?
Well, 70 or 72
is from the Torah. 71.
Well, they chose 70
as a Kenim. There's a Kenim in the days of Moshe, right? So Moshe identifies 6 from each Shevet, and then 2 of them are out, right? So they have the 70 pieces of paper, and 2 of them say, sorry, try again, and that ends up being Eldad and Medad in Parshas Baaloslo, right? So we have this idea of 72 being the set from which the 70 elders were taken. But this is very strange to see 72 listed here. The Rashash in Sanhedrin offers an interesting explanation. He says that perhaps the idea is that the Nasi is separate from the 71. The Nasi is the political leader of the Jews who are living in Israel, so maybe it's 71 from the Sanhedrin plus the Nasi makes 72, and that's where you get 72. Could be. There also are variations in terms of how many changes there are. The texts we've read have said 13. There's a Medrash, though, in Shmos Rabbah that says 18. The Medrash Tanchuma, which is a later volume of Medrash, says 12. There's Mechilta de Rabbi Shmuel that has 11. There's another version in the Medrash Tanchuma that says 10. All these different versions. Parenthetically, who gave you the right to change the Torah at all? What are you doing changing the Torah? We decided that we wanted to make things a little more clear. So I can just imagine that now we could have the next Art Scroll Stone Chumash, the next edition will be, we decided that people don't really understand when you write it this way, so we're just going to shift some of the words around. I'm not talking about on the English side, I'm not on the Hebrew side. So take a look at source number 5, where Shlomo Luria tries to explain that, because there is an issue that we call Ziyuv HaTorah. You're not allowed to forge the Torah. And the Maharshal, or Shlomo Luria, is very harsh about that. He says that any time you're going to change things from the Torah at all, that is a very, very serious crime. So he has to deal with how they could do it here. And in source number 5, his answer is that they weren't really changing it. What they were doing was changing their translation, because it was on the Greek side that they're doing it. They're changing their translation in order to match Torah. In other words, they wanted to get the concept of Torah, not the word order of Torah. That was really what mattered more to them, and therefore this was justified. Plus, all the versions of the story say that Hashem agreed with them. So, if Hashem agrees with you, there really isn't much more to discuss. But this is a problem. This isn't something to be taken lightly. These changes, though, are relatively minor for our purposes, in terms of number of sages, or in terms of how many changes that they made. Comparing our sources with external sources yields changes that I think offer us certain insights. The first external source I want to look at is what's called the Letter of Aristeus. Letter of Aristeus claims to be very old. It's generally been discredited by scholars, but I'll come back to that in a second. It claims to be from the 3rd century before the Common Era. It claims to be a letter written by a man named Aristeus, who's a member of the court of Ptolemy II, written to his brother Philocrates, and it's about the translation, and it's really about Judaism in general. And one of his themes is that he argues that Judaism and Hellenism can be reconciled, and Greeks have much to learn from Judaism. So scholars tend to think, although there are exceptions, that this letter was actually written by a Jew. And the goal of it was to speak to a Greek audience, or a Jewish and Greek audience, as a defender of Torah. It's a style where you want to defend something, and you write a letter and pretend to be of those who would not normally believe this. Right? He's claiming that he's a Greek. He covers a range of topics in his digressions, but the basic plot in the letter is that Demetrius is a librarian of Ptolemy in Alexandria. And he urges Ptolemy to have the Torah translated. And the king is very interested in this translation, He wants greater knowledge. He wants to build up and enrich his library. And so he bribes the Jews to do it. He sends gifts to the Beis HaMikdash. He frees thousands of Jewish slaves. And he sends a letter to the Kohen Gadol, a man named Eliezer, saying, please, please send me your greatest sages to do this this translation. The Kohen Gadol chooses 6 representatives from each Shevet, from each tribe, a total of 72. The king tests them at a great feast for their brilliance. He then sends them together to an island, and they complete the task in 72 days. The king rewards them greatly, and they have lifetime invitations to the king's court, and everybody goes home happy. Rather different from our account. Right? What are the differences between that and our record? Well, your turn. Yeah.
I was going to say, the separation versus working together. Mm-hmm. That's one. The thing is that the invitation and the compliance of the Kohen Gadol and the Jewish people reports that there's no explanation that the Jewish people were involved other than that at least to do all this, we just take it and don't write it.
Right. And right. Now it's a national activity.
It's a national activity and people are rewarded for it. There's no mention of that.
Right.
Aside from the fact that if you're taking 6 from each Shevet and there weren't exactly separate Shvatim at that time, we're not sure.
Right. We don't have 12 Shvatim at that point.
Right. 72 the only hole in that story, right? Right. The 72 people morphed into 72 days.
Right. The 72 clearly has some meaning for Aristeas, who's writing this. It's really remarkable.
Is 72 a number that has any significance in Greek culture?
Right. So I started looking into it. I didn't get very far. That's one of those things that I want to still explore further. I haven't found yet. Yes. All these donations, the 4 times high were coming in.
Gordon points out it has significance in Islamic.
In Islamic circles, do they always refer to the 72 versions?
That's a good point, but that's a long time after any of this. This story is well recorded before that. Right.
Where was this document found, and do we know for sure that it is as old as it claims to be?
Right, so we do know that it's 2nd century before the Common Era at the youngest. We just don't know if it's really 100 years earlier than that, the way it claims. It's clearly a record that, number one, Jews had at that time. So the Jews who are writing their stories about this know about Aristeas. As a matter of fact, one theory as to why Sophrim records a story of 5, and then it records a story of 72, is that he's stuck. He has 2 different versions. And so he decides, in classic Jewish style, to say, you're both right. And so it just must be these both happened at separate times. It's not so different from what we do in halacha, right? We have this view, we have this view, so we record both, and we try to satisfy everybody. So that's a possibility that they were working with that, with knowledge of that text. But we see that they're doing it as a group. They have knowledge of each other. There's no coercion involved, right? There's no mention in the letter of Aristeas of any changes in the Greek text, which I suppose isn't surprising. There are some differences between their version and ours. Rav Yaakov Emden, in his comments to the Gemara and Megillah on Daf Tes, says that actually the reason why there are some differences between that and ours is that this happened twice. So he takes the same approach that Maseches Sofrim does, but now think about it. What that means is he's claiming that it happened once with the Greeks rewarding us lavishly for doing a translation, and then it happened a separate time with coercion. It's a remarkable idea. But that's one non-Talmudic version of what happened. There's another non-Talmudic version of what happened, and this one comes from the city of Alexandria itself. And that is from Philo. Philo himself is a Jewish philosopher living in Alexandria in the 2nd century before the Common, the turn of the 1st century before the Common Era, somewhere around from like the year 120 to the year 60 before the Common Era, something like that. And he writes the Life of Moses. And he records this story as well. His story is very similar to that of Aristeas, but there are some key changes. One change is that in Aristeas' story, the sages are tested for their brilliance. And how well do they know Hebrew? How well do they know Greek? In his story, they're picked for their righteousness. How pious are they? It's not about how brilliant you are. It's about how pious you are. That's number one. Number two, they don't go to an island. They try to find a place that is tahor, that is pure. No impurity in that location. They go to a site outside the city. And number three, there's a detail added, and that is that they daven, they pray, in order to get it right. What do you see there in these three changes? That they're picked for their piety rather than their brilliance, that they go to a place that's pure, and that they pray to God to get this right. Yes?
Well, those three things are things that would be of importance to Jews, but not necessarily of value to Greek society.
Right. That's for sure true. I shouldn't say that entirely. I'm not so sure I agree with that, actually.
The brilliance would be important to the Greek society. Tahor versus non-tahor would be that important to Greek society.
Maybe.
They have that concept.
Could be.
And davening. I mean, obviously, we
call it davening. It sounds Jewish.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, but praying the Greeks and the Romans even more so. But the Greeks were pious people in certain ways to their own deities, but to an ephemeral deity, I don't think that would resonate with them.
Maybe. I'm going to come back to this because I think that I think it's actually a key point. What Philo is doing here is very important in how we understand the whole story. Another detail of his is that he describes an annual celebration that went on in Alexandria among the Jews, commemorating the translation. He says it's going on till his own day. They celebrate the translation of the Torah into Greek. Very different from our account that it's a day of darkness and associated with fasting and the like. So, number one lesson that I think we can learn from these variations. And this, I'm relying a lot on the work of Moshe Simon Shoshan in an article in a journal called Proof Texts. And it's a remarkable article. He notes differences between the two different traditions of how this happened in terms of whether we are comfortable with translation of Torah or whether we believe that you can't translate the Torah properly. One version of it is that, yes, Greek can do a good job. Aristeas seems to think so. And he says, you just get smart enough people, and then they'll be able to do the translation and everything will be fine. And that's his take. The sources that we have that come from Israel seem to support this idea. If you noticed it, and this is one of the ways in which looking at the outside sources shows certain things about our own, the sources that we quoted on this that came from Israel did not even talk about it as translation. They used the verb katav. They wrote certain things. They wrote the Torah. It's as though you write your Torah in Hebrew, you write your Torah in Greek. There isn't a variation. The Rishalmi's account of this matches that. It also matches, if you take a look on your sheet, source number 8. The Rishalmi says, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, they only permitted the translation of Tanakh into Greek because they checked and found the Torah can only be translated into Greek. No other language works. This is different from the view that we saw that said it was a dark cloud for the Jews for 3 days because, in fact, it wasn't a great thing because the Torah cannot be translated properly. They said, no, Greek works. There's a school of thought that says the Torah can be translated into Greek. That's one take. On the other hand, Philo doesn't think so. Philo, or Philon, is of the view that the Torah can't be translated properly into Greek. And that's perhaps the idea behind his changes. When he says that they're picked for their piety, not necessarily for their brilliance, they go to a place which is tahor, which is pure, so they can commune with God. They daven, they pray in advance. Right? They need divine assistance. Because it's not possible on a human level for Torah to be translated into another language and still maintain the nuances of Torah. And that's what we saw in those other texts, like the one from Sophrim. When you look back again at source number 3, and it says that the day was as harsh for Israel as the day the calf was created because the Torah could not be properly translated. Right? That's their take. So we have a debate going on between the different accounts as to whether it's possible to render Torah in another language. That's one debate between these different versions. The number 2... To add to that note, it's broader than just the question of whether you can translate it. We have to add the question of whether you're supposed to translate it. Maybe we don't like translation. And if you take a look on your sheets at source number 9. This is from the Medrash Tanchuma. The Medrash Tanchuma is coming in fairly late in the game in terms of its redacting. We're already talking 7th, 8th, maybe even 9th century before it's actually compiled and edited fully. Although the sages that is quoting are much earlier. But take a look. Amar Rav Yehuda Halevi Rabbi Shalom. Bikesh Moshe Shetehei Ap HaMishna B'Ksav. Moshe Rabbeinu said, why are you giving us a spoken Torah to go with a written Torah? Wouldn't it be great if everything was in writing? Why did you need a spoken Torah in the first place? So the answer that's given in this medrash is Safa Kadosh Baruch Hu al she'asidin umos ha'olam letargim es ha'Torah velikros osa yivanis. God saw that the nations of the world would translate the Torah into Greek and read it. V'hein omrim af anu Yisrael, and they would say, "We are Jews also." Who's he talking about? Right, the early Christians translating the Torah into Greek, using the Greek as the basis for their text, and identifying themselves as Jews. So Amar Le Hakadosh Baruch Hu, so Hashem said, and now he takes a pasuk in Hosea, Echtov Lecha Rubei Tarasi Kamo Zarnech Shavu. Hashem says, I will write Rubei Tarasi, the majority of my Torah, and that way those others will be considered Zar. Will be considered strangers, because they won't be able to claim Torah. We'll keep the spoken Torah for ourselves, and no one will be able to pass themselves off as Jews. That's another reason to oppose translation, is it makes the Torah too usable by others. Along with this, another lesson from the contrast and comparison with the letter of Aristeus and of Philo, do we view the translation as a tribute, or do we view it as an attack? Meaning, in Aristeus' version, it's an honor, right? The great Greek king writes away to us and says, please, I'll do anything to get you to translate the Torah for me. All you have to do is come here and write it. I'm going to give you great gifts. I'll free slaves. I'll donate to your temple. Whatever you want, just give me a translation of your Torah. We are in the superior position. He's coming to us and saying, you have something that I want. Please, please, won't you provide it? Having seen that in Aristeus, we now look at our sources, right? And in our sources, it doesn't look like that at all, because now we're sensitized to see certain things. He takes the sages, he doesn't tell them what they're doing. He puts them in 72 different houses, and only then does he tell them what's going on. He's imprisoning them, right? It's a hostile thing. This is what you do to a hostile witness. You're afraid he isn't going to tell you the truth. So therefore, you isolate him from everybody else, and you get him to tell you his story in order to verify it based on the stories of others. So I think what we also see in this is that from the perspective of the sages, this was generally considered to be a hostile act, the requirement that we translate it. Whereas Aristeus sees it in a very positive light, to us it was considered a negative. We didn't like this. We didn't like the idea that the Torah should be translated. So again, just to make sure that we understand what we've said so far, we've seen the stories, we've seen the variations, we saw our version, we saw also the versions that are recorded from outside of Medrash and Gemara, and I think what we see, aside from the changes in how many elders did it or how many alterations we made, is that number one, there's a great debate as to whether it's possible to translate Torah, That's number one. And number two, there's a certain hostility to it in our sources where we can't believe that sages would have been willing to do this on their own. It must have been forced upon us by Ptolemy. Now, there is an alternative approach that's been current in historians throughout the last 200 years. They don't like this story that emerges in Aristaeus. They don't like it because it involves miracles, first of all. Not Aristaeus' version, but our version involves miracles of sages doing the same translation when they're in different rooms. Historians get uncomfortable with that sort of thing. They don't like it also because it sounds too much like a story that Jews would have told in order to elevate themselves. So therefore, they've come up with another idea, which is an interesting idea, which is the translation was not at Ptolemy's insistence at all. In fact, Ptolemy was not involved, but rather we did it. And the reason we did it was because the Jews living in Alexandria didn't know Hebrew. And therefore, we needed a translation into the vernacular. The idea should not surprise us. The Rambam writes in the beginning of Hilchos Tefillah that the reason why we have a set Shmona Esrei is because the Jews who came back from Babel, from Babylon, weren't fluent in Hebrew, and therefore they needed a davening that would be in Hebrew, that would be written for them and set as a text that they could learn, and then they would all be able to daven in Hebrew. So the idea of a Jewish population needing a text like this is not new. It also fits, quite frankly, with various sources that we have from that time in terms of the knowledge of Hebrew and Greek among Jews. If you take a look on your sheets, this is just a little bit of what's really a much bigger topic. But source number 8, actually not number 8, excuse me, no, source number 10. This is describing boxes in the Beis HaMikdash. We are familiar with the collection of Machtes HaShekel, the half shekel donation, in which every Jew was supposed to give a half shekel to the temple, to the Beis HaMikdash, every year. Well, three times during the course of the year, the Kohanim would go into the room where the Shkalim were stored, and they would take out the Shkalim that they were going to need for the expenditures of the Beis HaMikdash. Take a look at what's described here in the Mishnah. B'shalosh kupos shalosh shalosh se'in torminus halishka. They used three boxes, each one capable of holding three se'ah, which is a volume measure, and they used those to collect the half shkalim. The kasuv b'hen aleph bet gimel. They were marked aleph beis gimel. But Rabbi Yishmael omer yevanis kasuv b'hen. Rabbi Yishmael says no. It was actually marked in Greek alpha beta gamma. In the Beis HaMikdash, the boxes used by the Kohanim are marked Alpha, Beta, Gamma. Why? The answer, brought by the commentators on this, is because that's the language they spoke. If you take a look at source number 11, look at this. Omrim Tzedukim, there is a law that says that Kisvei Kodesh, holy scrolls, communicate tumah. They communicate impurity. It's a long story. It has to do with Kohanim hiding their truma in these scrolls, and then the scrolls were getting eaten by mice. It's a rabbinic enactment that the scrolls communicate impurity. So the Sadducees, which is, you know, what are Sadducees is a great longer discussion, but the Sadducees say that's not logical. They say, Kovlin anu aleichem prushim. We complain against you, you Pharisees. Sha'atem omrim kisvei kodesh mitamenes hayadayim v'sifrei homris einon mitamenes hayadayim. You say that holy writings communicate impurity to your hands, but the books of homris do not. What are they talking about? What is the books of Homerus? Homer. Various Mepharshim have tried to explain this in other ways to suggest that it's not Homer, but I think the most simple and straightforward explanation that's offered is indeed that this is the Tiferes Yisrael's explanation, that this is Homer. And the Sadducees are saying, how can it be that holy texts communicate impurity, but Homer, who is mundane, does not communicate impurity? If holy texts communicate impurity, certainly other texts should. And the argument back is given there in the Gemara, in the Mishnah, it's not our point. My point is familiarity with Homer. In the Mishnah in Yadayim. And then take a look at source number 12, perhaps in a sense the most shocking one. Rabbi Levi Bar Chaisa, Aza LeKesarin. Rabbi Levi Bar Chaisa goes to Caesarea. Shama Kolun Karyan Shema Elonistin. And he heard the people reciting Shema Elonistin. What is Elonistin? Hellenic. Hellenist. They're saying Shema in Greek. And he wants to stop them. boy Makab to it. He wants to stop them and say, you can't do that. That's not how you say Shema. One second. Shema Rabbi Yossi Vekbid. Rabbi Yossi said, no, don't stop them. Omer Ka Omer Ani Misha'eno Yodea Likros Ashur is Lo Yikrena Kol Iker. He says, if someone doesn't know how to read Shema in the original, then he shouldn't read Shema at all. No, better he should say Shema. He can fulfill the mitzvah in any way in which he's able to read Shema. Yes?
I was just going to say that, agreeing with your earlier argument about the lingua franca, it seems that the two ceremonies that you have here from the Yerushalmi seem to be much more lenient about Greek than the Babli is.
Mm-hmm.
And in Israel, Greek would have become a lingua franca, and Babel probably never was a lingua franca.
Right.
So it makes sense that they're more lenient.
Quite possibly. Quite possibly. I'm not 100% sure because of some pieces of Megillah Daftez, Megillah 9-8, but overall I think that it's consistent. In the second century, the time of Hanukkah, you find scrolls, Dead Sea Scrolls from that time that include Greek. If you look in the Book of Maccabees, it describes the Yehuda HaMaccabee and others speaking Greek in order to negotiate the various treaties with the Greeks themselves. As a matter of fact, the Rambam is very interesting. The Rambam, in his commentary to Mishnah in the second chapter of Megillah, actually says, he does a cart-horse flip. He says the reason Greek was current among the Jews was because of the translation of the Torah into Greek. That popularized the use of Greek. I thought that was an interesting flip of what's usually considered the logical order. We know the Jews in Alexandria were very familiar with Greek. So it is possible to contend that there is a logic to the claim by the historians that Jews were more familiar with Greek and actually wanted to do this. What stops me from saying that ultimately is that we have a tradition in the Gemara that says that's not what happened. I'm not willing to drop the Gemara for what is essentially a theory without evidence. It's an interesting theory. Conceptually it does work. I don't see evidence to it, and I have a version in the Gemara, so I'm not about to drop what we have. Whether we wanted that particular translation or not, whether we were comfortable with the translation or not, we did ultimately accept Greek as a special language. Throughout the Gemara, we find translation of words in the Torah into Greek. The Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Lamed Aleph Amud Beis, the pasuk says, "Hein yiras Hashem hi chachma." It says the word "hein" in Greek is one, and that teaches me lessons on that pasuk. Similarly, Shabbos Samach Gimel Amud Beis, there's the word "lamas," and they say "mas" in Greek is dog, and they teach a lesson that way. Osoves hence and Hedron Ayin Vav Amud Beis. There are a whole series of passages in the Torah, which in the Gemara and in the Medrash Tanchuma are translated, biblical texts are translated using Greek words to explain what a Hebrew word would have meant. Greek is also recognized in law. We talk about using it for translation of Torah, we talk about using it for translation of legal documents, and there's general praise in the Gemara for Greek. Take a look at source number 13, please. Gemara also in Megillah. And this is one of those that shows a Babylonian openness to Greek as well. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, "Af bisfarim lo itirushi kasvu ele yavanis," even other books, meaning the prophets, may only be recorded in Greek. And Amar Rabbi Avo, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, halacha Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, the law follows Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. V'Amar Rabbi Yochanan, my time of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Rabbi Yochanan asks, what's the reason for Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's position? Omar Krok, as the Torah says, Yaf Elokim li Yafes v'yishkon be'ahale shem. So Hashem should either broaden, Yaf may mean broaden, or Hashem should beautify Yafet, and he should dwell in the tents of shame. So now, this is what he does with that. Yaf Elokim li Yafet. Yafet is one of the three sons of Noah. Yafes has a whole bunch of kids, including Yavan. Right? There's Gomer, Magog, Madai, Yavan, Meshach, and Tiras. So Yavan is one of the sons of Yafet. Yavan is Greece. So may God beautify Yefet, and he should dwell in the tents of shame, means the words of Yefet, meaning Greek, should be in the tent of shame, shame being our ancestor. Shame, Ham, and Yefet are the three sons of Noah. Shame is our ancestor. That's where you get the idea of Semitic, descendant of shame. So he says, that's how you know that Greek is an acceptable language for translation of Torah. But then the Gemara asks, Yefet had other kids. Why do you assume it's Greek? Maybe it's Gomer's language. Maybe it's Magog's language. How do you know that it's Greek? The Gemara asks, Ve'ema Gomer u'Magog. Perhaps it should be the language of Gomer and Magog. To which Rabbi Chiya bar Abba explains, no, because the Torah says, Yaft Elokim liyefes, taking Yaft as beautiful, Yaft yuso shall yefes yehe be'ohale shame. The greatest beauty of Yefet should be in the tents of shame. Greek is the most beautiful language among those of the descendants of Yefet. Purely an aesthetic idea. I would have expected something more philosophical to explain why Greek, but it really seems to be based on aesthetics. If you take a look at source number 14, it's a longer source. I'm not going to end up getting to most of it, but the one point that I wanted to get to is the quote from Rebbe. It's in the middle in the English translation that I did there. It's the middle section, the middle paragraph. If you look in the Hebrew, it starts at the end of the fourth line. V'chachmas yivanis mi asira. There's a story there which leads to the prohibition against against studying Greek wisdom, and they challenge the prohibition on Greek wisdom by saying, "Va'atanya Omar Rebbe be'eretz Yisrael lashon sursi lama o lashon akodesh o lashon yivanis." Rebbe said, "If you're in Israel, you shouldn't speak sursi. Sursi is Aramaic. You should not speak sursi. What you should speak instead is either Hebrew lashon akodesh or Greek." So Rebbe is praising Greek. Take a look, please, at source number 15 from the Talmud Yerushalmi. It says, there are four beautiful languages for the world to use. Laz, which is Greek, for song. Romi likrav. Romi is Latin, and that's for krav. Krav is either battle, or some commentators suggest it's actually likarev, to draw people close, to persuade them in debate. That Latin is better for debate. I find debating in Latin actually makes things harder for me, but I don't know. Sursi la'ayla, Aramaic for wailing and mourning, and Ivri l'dibur, Hebrew as far as speech, and then among the alphabets they add in Ashuri l'ksav Assyrian, meaning the ksav Ashuri, the Assyrian alphabet that we use for text. Take a look at source 16. Rabbi Avo quotes Rabbi Yochanan, "You're allowed to teach your daughter Greek. It is an ornament for her. It's great for women to know Greek." There's a whole discussion as to why for a girl specifically. But the Karban Eidah there explains on that Yerushalmi is that they can curry political favor with the aristocracy. What's going on here with all this praise for Greek? The answer seems to be that the sages had an admiring ear for language. And they weren't afraid that we would be somehow diminishing respect for Torah by saying that Greek could in fact be beautiful. Rashi says it in Bava Kamma on that long passage, source number 14. Rashi says Greek is Lashon Tzach. It's a pure language. It's a refined language. And therefore it's good. The Bartanura, the Mishnah and Shkalim that we read that talked about Alpha, Beta, Gamma, says they use Greek because it's a beautiful language. The Rambam also, in his commentary to the second chapter in Megillah, the same one where he said we got to know Greek because of the translation, says that Greek is a really beautiful language. Apparently, there simply was this acceptance of the idea that it could be aesthetically pleasing. So as I suspected in the beginning, we're not going to get to to talk about the ban on Chochmas Yevanis, the later ban on Greek wisdom, which comes into play a little bit later in history. You can see the sources that I have there, and maybe that will help somewhat. But maybe at some point we'll revisit that in the future. Thank you very much.